Our scripture lesson today continues in our sermon series, looking at a different character, pivotal hero of the faith from the Old Testament. And today we look at the character of Samuel. Not starting at the beginning of his story when he's called as a young boy, not starting in the midst of his ministry when he serves as a prophet and as a judge, the final judge who is sort of like a military leader and ruler over the people, not in the midst of all the hardship that comes from his leadership and all the success that he has as well, but rather we pick up closer to the end of his life when this most important person in the land up until now, Samuel, is approached by leaders who are asking, as we heard in our children's message, for something else, something new. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "You are old." Now, that's not the best way to start a request to your leader. "You are old, and your sons do not follow in your ways. Appoint for us, then, a king to govern us like other nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us." Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Just as they have done to me from the day I brought them out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so also they are doing to you. Now then, listen to their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take one-tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day, you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. For a reason I can't exactly put my fingers on, the character of Samuel has for a long time been my favorite Old Testament figure. He's sort of obscure in a sense, but he's very important at the same time. I'm not sure why he's caught my attention so much. Maybe it's because of the miraculous circumstances around his birth. His mother Hannah, who, like the Old Testament foremothers in the past, was barren and prayed and finally received him as a gift. She prayed a song to God that served as the model of the song that Mary would sing and pray later when she found out she was pregnant with Jesus. Maybe it's because Samuel heard God's call early in life and his story isn't one of some drastic change and grand revelation, but rather of a steady presence of following God's call throughout life. Maybe it's because he's hard to pin down. You can't put a title on Samuel because his role shifts and changes through time. Sometimes he's a prophet. Sometimes he's a priest. Sometimes he's a judge, a military ruler. He's the first one to anoint the kings who will follow. But recently, in just the last few years, I've been thinking a lot about Samuel because he's this super important transition figure in the history of the Old Testament. Everything that comes before Samuel looks extremely different from everything that comes after him. The life of Samuel is a pivot point in the way that the Hebrews lived and how they organized themselves and understood themselves. Everything before him, going all the way back to the days of the Exodus, wandering in the wilderness, and then coming into the Promised Land, and then living there for generations and generations, the Hebrews had been organized around a tribal system. The 12 tribes, each with their own land, each with their own leaders. Occasionally, God would raise up a judge to help a few of the tribes, or even many of the tribes, work together to defeat a common enemy. But then when the job was done, the role of the judge would go away. It wasn't passed down and inherited. It was just for a time when needed. And then God would let things return back to normal. But everything after Samuel changes. You have the beginning of the monarchy. First with the king Saul, the bad king, and then with King David, the man after God's own heart, and from the line of David begins this anointed line of monarchs that follow. Many of them were horrible leaders, a few stood out as important, but from the days of Samuel on, the fact that there was a king in Israel was a given. It was assumed. The monarchy was part of what it meant to be a Hebrew in the land. But during Samuel, during his lifetime, is when that transition happens. As we heard, Samuel is not a fan of this new system of government when he first hears it. Because where does it come from? Like putting your sister on the rim of a bike, the Hebrews' desire for a king is rooted in wanting to be like everybody else. All those other kingdoms have a king to lead them, to organize them, to charge into battle. The Philistines have a king. All the other Canaanites have a king. All the people we're fighting against have one. We want a king to be like everybody else, someone to fight our battles for us so we don't have to bother ourselves with the work. Now you see here in the text, Samuel isn't just opposed to this because he's an old stick in the mud who remembers the good old days of the tribes and the judges. He's not opposed to this even so much on practical grounds, but on theological grounds. Because ever since the time of the Exodus, the Hebrews have wandered around, have come into the land, have fought and won victories and established themselves without the presence of a monarch. Because they understood and believed that God alone was their king. Why do you need an earthly king when you have a heavenly king to lead you, to guide you, to win your battles, to organize your community? Why do you need an earthly king? Just because everybody else has one? And Samuel's ticked off. He goes and he prays to God, "What's wrong with these people? Look what they've done. They've rejected me." And God says, "No, you are right in the first place. They've rejected me, God. So warn them. Tell them what it's going to be like." And we have the Old Testament version of taxation without representation laid out here. Samuel talks about all that the king will take from you. Your family, your livelihood, your very lives themselves. You will become his slaves. You want someone else to fight your battles for you? In truth, you're still going to be the ones fighting. But you're not going to have a say in it. Samuel's opposed to the monarchy from the start. But here's the fascinating thing. As the rest of the story unfolds, as he goes and anoints Saul, the one who is the strapping, strong leader who looks like the spitting image of what a king should appear like, and as Saul crumbles and fails, and then God sends Samuel to go and anoint another king, a scrawny little shepherd boy who likes to sit out in the fields and write poetry, a fellow by the name of David who has none of the appearance of a king, Samuel goes along throughout the rest of his life's journey, following where God sends him, anointing people to serve in the very position that he opposed from the start. He's the one who blesses the royal line, through whom the blessing of God will continue on and on and on through the ages, coming all the way down to Christ the King, born centuries later. In other words, with gritted teeth, and I'm sure some second guessing along the way, Samuel's journey from this moment on is one of changing his mind. He's opposed to the monarchy, and yet he is the kingmaker, the one who anoints God's chosen ones. He changes his mind over time on one of the most important issues facing his people, from which their kingdom will never be the same. If Samuel was around running for office today, he'd have a hard time getting elected, wouldn't he? You changed your mind. That means you're not stable. You're not strong in your convictions. You changed your mind. No, we want leaders who have never thought something different from the time they were 18 until they are now. We want leaders who never change their minds on any issues. At least that's how we act. Just this week I heard a politician running for office being interviewed, and the reporter asked about a particular pivotal issue on which this politician has changed his mind. And he said, in a rare moment of candor, "Yes, I used to think that, and then I wasn't so sure. And now I think I may have been wrong. And this is where I am now." I was amazed, excited, until the follow-up question from the reporter, "Well, you've only recently changed your mind. Doesn't that put you behind a vast majority of our country on this topic? We can't change our minds, and then when we do, if we haven't changed them long enough, or if we're too quick, we're not good enough." Samuel is a model of spiritual growth along the journey that God lays out. Not, "Here is everything clear as day, just follow steps 1, 2, and 3, rinse and repeat." But hold on tight, Samuel, because the journey is going to take you places you didn't know. Your views, your worldviews, your assumptions about how things are structured may look a little different by the time you get to the other side of this journey. That's not called being flippant. That's called maturing in faith. That's called following a servant, Lord. And so Samuel's kingdom, country, looks vastly different than it did. And he plays a pivotal role pointing to God at every step along the way. It reminds me in many ways of what we're talking about in our worship service today, that pivotal time of transition for us in this country 2.5 centuries ago, when forebearers in this land decided that it was time for a change. Instead of turning to a king, the colonists wanted to turn away from the king, to declare independence, to fight a revolution, if it came to it, which it did. To spill blood and tears, to give up so much that freedom might be won. And there were leaders, Presbyterians in particular, who started life's journey with one assumption about what it meant to be a good Christian, to serve king and country, who ended life's journey seeing things differently. Some of them were revolutionaries from the start, but many of them took a long time to get there. Our founding fathers and founding mothers were not all people who grew up pledging allegiance to a flag before it existed. They went through life's journey. Like Samuel, many, especially of the Presbyterian leaders and church leaders, sought to point to God's presence in the midst of an old model during a time of transition and into the birth of something new. There's countless leaders in the early beginnings of our country who were shaped and formed by a reformed theology that understood God to be king and sovereign first and foremost, and therefore no pattern of government to be absolute. And if a new model could bring more freedom and more opportunity to serve God, who alone is Lord of the conscience, then so be it. There are stories early on, in the very beginning of the revolts and the turmoil that was starting here in the American soil, when word spread all the way back to the British Parliament that there were members of Parliament who began to refer to this big war that we know as the American Revolutionary War. In the very early days, there were members of Parliament who referred to it as that Presbyterian Revolt, because there were so many of us that were involved in leading it. There are stories of, for instance, the Battle of Kings Mountain, where on a Sunday morning, the pastor preached about the need to serve God and to work for freedom. And then at the end of the service, the elders led the charge, and the people went from church to the battlefield, fighting for independence. The role of the church was not to become the new king, but to point to God's presence along the journey. It reminds me in many ways of where we find ourselves today, perhaps more so than any age in recent history. We are in a time of pivotal transition. The world as we know it is changing now at a faster rate than it ever has. Just this week, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon. As amazing and fascinating as these celebrations have been, how many of you had moon pies to celebrate, by the way? No? As amazing as that anniversary celebration was, I kept finding myself thinking how different things are now in just those last 50 years. Right? They say that there's more computer power in what we carry around in our phone than the massive supercomputers that were used to land people on something in orbit. We're in a time of pivotal transition, not just because of technology. We have growing globalization. We have a world that seems to be ratcheting up in intensity and down in truthfulness and caring about facts and caring about one another. We live in a time where commitment to institutions is no longer a given, where people aren't looking necessarily for the duty of following in the footsteps of those who've gone before, but are looking for authenticity. Where's real life being changed? That's where I want to be a part of what God is doing. So it strikes me that in response to this new changing world we live in, we've got a few choices on how to react. Certainly we could pull the covers over our head and pretend like nothing is changing, like everything is still the same. We could pull the curmudgeon approach. Sounds a lot like Samuel here in our biblical text. Let me tell you how bad things are now, how awful they will become if we continue on this trajectory. Let me tell you how good it was back in the good old days. For some of us, maybe. For some of us. What keeps our memories, though, from becoming mere nostalgia about the past is when we can be open and honest, both about the goodness that we are missing and about the imperfections that are part of our story. When we can confess sin and move forward in grace at the same time, in the same breath. We can let the past become the tyrant that seeks to rule and govern all our thoughts, or we can let the future become the tyrant as well. That anything new is better because it's new and bigger and shinier. Change for change's sake, who cares what we're losing? Neither of those tyrants of nostalgia or empty newness seem to be enough? For those who follow our sovereign King, maybe, just maybe, we can go into our day, we can run this race set before us and our generation, rooted in memory and hopeful for what God is doing. Some of the changes we're a part of creating, others are happening whether we are on the ride or not. Maybe as society shifts from the power of Christendom into something that may seem powerless, we can embrace this as an opportunity to share the gospel in a new way, to live into Paul's vision of power made perfect in weakness. Maybe as people are less inclined to grasp towards institutions, we can become communities of authenticity. We can become, as we have been at our best, the places where people are welcomed to meet and encounter the risen Christ in our midst. Maybe we, like Samuel, like our Presbyterian forebearers in this country, can point to the presence of God, which passes all understanding, can point to the presence of God with us now, even as the world around us seems to change. I think in many ways, that shift from the old tribal system to the new monarchy, the role that Samuel plays for the people, he's sort of, for me, the patron saint of interim pastors. Maybe we need to be an interim church in today's world, like Samuel, to celebrate what has gone before, but not face what is new with fear. Because we know the truth, that even as things change, we follow the path that is laid out by our prophet, our priest, our King, Jesus Christ, to whom be all honor and glory now and forever. Amen.